You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. Now, I'm delighted to say Michael Lister is here with us this morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. How are we all today?
Yeah, very good. How are you getting on?
I'm getting on good. I'm sort of coming down a little bit in the world this week because last weekend I was in Killarney at the Rally of the Lakes fraternising with Michael Fassbender.
Right.
Yeah, we were kind of chilling together.
Right.
As you do, you know.
He was driving, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. Michael was competing in the event. It was the 40th anniversary of the Rally of the Lakes, so he was involved in the rally, driving. He brought the car home. That's all you can do for your first ever rally. So, you know, fair play to him. But a good guy, nice guy. And he was a great ambassador down there during the week for the rally and all that kind of thing. So that was nice.
His celebrity is like a different stratosphere now. It's kind of reached that kind of, you know, Hollywood A-lister.
Oh, sure, of course. I mean, that's the whole point about it. Like, everybody, and particularly younger people, know who Michael Fassbender is through the movies and all that kind of stuff, you know. And that was a big buzz, as I said, for the rally and for the community down there because, you know, the top drivers within rallying, everybody knows who they are. But outside that, in the wider community, most people don't actually know, kind of, you know. But everybody knew who Michael Fassbender was, yeah. So, yeah.
Like, if you were asked what your first love is, the answer would really be rallying, right? That's
From a participation point of view, for sure, yeah. And it's just one of those things. It was a sport that I got involved in. And it's, when I did my first rally, one of the other competitors said to me, "This is a disease, you know." And he was right because 30 years later, I'm still involved in it, you know. And that's,
how did
that's
the first
the
one come about, though? What was the impetus in the first place?
When I joined RTE, I was actually covering rallies or covering the Circuit of Ireland, anyway. And myself and Vincent Hogan from the Irish Independent, we kind of hang around together in the rallies. We'd be sitting on bar stools in the evening and saying, "Do you know what? We should have a crack at this sometime." So when my old mug got on the Sunday game and all that, I realised I could actually get sponsorship and put the package together financially. So we just decided we would do... If you're going to go rallying and you're going to start off in a sport, it's like you decide to take up hurling. What'll I do? I'll play in the All-Ireland final.
Yeah.
So we started off... The first rally we did was in the Circuit of Ireland. Which we were not entitled to do, by the way, but that's another issue. In terms of our license, we got a license.
It was the 80s.
And off we went, and we competed in the thing. And as I said to you, that was just one of those things. You came away from it and you said, right, when is the next event? When can I get the money together to do something else? Kind of, you know, and it went on a bit like that.
What is it? The adrenaline rush? Is that what the viruses are?
It's the adrenaline rush. It is the challenge. It's tough sport, like I suppose most sports are, I guess. But it was also the camaraderie because, you know, guys within the sport of rallying would be very helpful to each other, even though you're competing against guys. I was doing the Galway rally one year, and on the way out from Galway City out to the first stage out near Ardrahan, the clutch went in the car. So we drove the first three stages of the rally with no clutch. But what this involved was the guys behind me pushing me off the start line.
Right.
And they all did it. They all gave me the push and got me going and all that. But all I could hear as I was being pushed off the line was mumblings and mutterings of four-letter words and the fucking... and all this kind of... But they pushed. Because what that meant, then they had to jump back into their own cars and get strapped up and go, kind of, you know. But I didn't take too much time off them with no clutch, by the way, so they were happy enough from that point of view.
So. I would say so. But like, it seems like it's quite a complicated sport to learn. So you and Vincent's your co-driver, is he?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. He was my co-driver for a lot of my time in rallying, but I had other co-drivers, and obviously Vincent, like myself, I suppose, because of our commitments in sport and at weekends, it wasn't always possible for the two of us to be there. But we did a lot of rallies together, I have to say, over the years.
That's a weird relationship, because you've got to trust.
It is. We've often talked about that. It's a very, very strange relationship in the sense that you so depend on each other. And when I say depend on each other for your safety and everything else, but it's also very intense because you're sitting, I remember doing the Circuit of Ireland one year, and it was the last of the old circuits, which began on Friday and ended on Easter Monday. So that's a long time, and it went all around Ireland and the usual kind of thing. And you're sitting in the car with somebody for 4 days.
Yeah.
after about two, you're pretty much fed up with each other, kind of, you know. And there were long periods. I mean, if you're on a 70-mile drive to get to the next stage and you're sitting there and the two of you are looking out the window and nobody's really saying anything, because at this stage you haven't got a lot to say anyway, kind of, you know. But so it's that kind of relationship. But we made it, I think we made a good partnership.
And you're still rallying?
I'm still involved in it, yeah. I haven't actually competed over the last couple of years for one reason or another, and health issues being a main reason. But for instance, last weekend down in Killarney, I was doing sweeper car, which is not competing, but it's going around after the field in a rally car. And in rallying, there's this build up and build down. So before the competition cars arrive on the stage, there will be a number of other cars go through, official cars and road safety checks and blah de blah. And then at the other end, it's that same thing. It's a kind of a slowdown so that the people don't get giddy and start walking around in the middle of the road when there's still cars actually coming and things like that. So that's how I got chatting so much last weekend to Michael Fassbender, because he was running at the back of the field. So at the beginning of stages, you'd be hanging around waiting for things to happen. Yeah. And batting the breeze and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and did he get the bug? Is he going to be an annual?
Well, yeah, I'd say so. I don't know about the bug for rallying, although I suspect he might, but he's actually competed in circuit racing a fair bit.
Okay, right.
In sports car racing. Right. So he wasn't a newbie to competing in cars, but a newbie to rallying, which is, it's a different discipline for obvious reasons. It's a bit like saying somebody who's an international rugby player taking up Gaelic football. Okay, you can play football, but can you play Gaelic? Yeah. You know, so that, it was a bit of that kind of thing. But as I said, I was talking to a couple of people who were out watching the stages, and they reported he was given it welly. So you like to hear that about yourself.
It's a gold star. Like, are you interested in the structural side of cars as well?
Like, no.
You don't have a rally car parked up at home?
I was always an arrive and drive competitor.
Right, okay.
Yeah, somebody else prepared the car and I'd sit in it. But don't ask me how it worked.
So. And do you find yourself doing a lot more of that now since the Sunday game is finished up? Is it kind of like the predominant thing that you focus your free time on?
Ah, no, not at all. I mean, it's been a hobby, but that's all it's ever been. And there are definitely out there, there are petrol heads. There are fellas who live and breathe this kind of stuff. You know, I'm definitely not one of them. I enjoy it, and I've enjoyed, we'd say, last weekend, I'm a life member of the Galway Motor Club, so I'd be involved a little bit with them as well. But no, I mean, I can walk away from the thing as well and not bother about it. In actual fact, part of the reason that I haven't competed for a couple of years is I've been too lazy to go about getting my license renewed, which I did let lapse, which was a mistake because I had an international rally license. And I let that lapse, and now I have to kind of go through the process of building it up again. But it's one of those things, you also have to remind yourself that you're actually in your mid-60s, not your mid-20s, kind of, you know. So going around acting the pup in rally cars doesn't go with the scene. But
I'm not sure reminding yourself of your age is actually a good thing anymore. You should just forget about it and sure, whatever happens, happens.
I have a friend, and she said to me one time years ago, we were talking about this, and she said, if you didn't know what age you were, what age would you think you were? And I think that's one of the best sayings that I've ever heard, because I actually think I'm 25. So in my head, and as my wife often reminds me, I act 25 a lot of the times as well. So
fair play, fair play. Fair. It's that time of year when obviously the Sunday game is back.
Yeah.
How does that feel? Are you missing that a bit?
No, I have to say I'm not. I watched the Sunday game last Sunday. And I had the only dilemma I had was watching the Sunday game last Sunday. I was also trying to watch the Spanish Grand Prix. So I was kind of doing a small bit of flicking for the Waterford Clare match, and then I watched the Tip Cork match and that. But no, it was perfectly fine. I'm sat at home, I'm watching it halfway through the Tip Cork match. I opened a bottle of Peroni, and which I couldn't do if I was actually presenting the Sunday game. It's not recommended anyway. But so no, it was fine. I was happy out. There was no problem. As I've said to people, I did it for 35 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
And I've done my stint. It's not like somebody came along and said to you, listen, thanks for everything, but we found somebody else and we think they're the way to go forward or whatever. I just came to a natural end, and I always knew, 5 years ago this natural end was coming. So that there wasn't any kind of disappointment in that. And the other thing about it is, now that I'm not in RT and now that I'm not involved at the Sunday game or League Sunday, which has gone before it, of course, I have more time to do other things, and I can make commitments to do other things that I wouldn't normally do, because this time of the year, you would be pretty much locked in to the programme. There would be a lot of it's not just a case of rocking up on a Sunday. There would be a lot of production meetings, and I always wrote my own scripts and did my own research and all that kind of stuff. I preferred to do it that way. So that involved a lot of work during the week. So you were doing that and you weren't doing other things. Whereas last week, as I said, I was in Killarney at the weekend for the Rally of the Lakes. I was in Cork before that for an Irish Heart Foundation event. I'm going to Sligo this weekend for a CPR launch of a community down in Sligo. And while I'm there, I might just catch the Sligo Galway match as well, right? Because it's in Sligo, it's in Markovitz Park. So it's a bit like that. You know, you stop doing one thing and you start doing other things.
Yeah, yeah. The CPR and the Irish Heart Foundation, these are obviously very important in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wonder, a life-changing moment like you have had, what difference does that make to your outlook?
I suppose I'm every day, I think, at some point in the day, I'm conscious of this event that happened to me. This was my cardiac arrest in 2015. And it crosses your mind all the time. But I don't dwell on it. And it isn't something that kind of stands over me. You just get on with your life. I should be dead. I mean, that's not being too dramatic about it. But I'm not. So, you know, just get on with it.
And just explain to people, because cardiac arrest and heart attack are different things.
Yeah.
Cardiac arrest, you're not supposed to survive.
No, you're not supposed to survive. And I understand totally where this confuses people. I had two events. I had heart failure in 2012, which was physically a more serious scenario because you were in serious physical health trouble at that stage. The cardiac arrest in 2015, your heart just stops. And people would say to me, and how are you since your heart attack? And, you know, and were you feeling bad? Did you get pains? Which is understandable, you know, because that's what happens in a heart attack. You get a blocked artery or some other thing goes wrong in your heart. With a cardiac arrest, something in my brain, the impulses that go from your brain to your heart, stop working. And in most people being in about 94%, I think, of people who suffer a cardiac arrest, don't survive. And the one or two that do survive, most of them, it happens to them in hospital where they have the medical facilities to possibly revive you. So I'm in that bracket, and it's if you think about it, it's totally freaky. But you could drive yourself crack thinking about it as well. And as I said to you, look at, I got away with it. I'm still alive. I don't know for how long. Let's be honest with ourselves here. The fact that it happened once doesn't mean it'll never happen again, of course. But that's not the point. You just take day by day. And that's all anybody can do. Because one thing that's always struck me since this happened in 2015 is you pick up the papers or you look at your phone app and your news app and things like that. And somebody gets killed in a car crash. Or, you know, dies in tragic circumstances like that. And you look at them and you look at the age and somebody's 23 or 22, whatever the case may be, and you think to yourself, that's too young to die. You know, that's so you don't know. I mean, you can't protect yourself from the dangers of life, whatever shape they might come in.
Did it go the other way at all, that you're kind of, you know, you're more energized about stuff going, okay, well, this is a very random second chance that I've been given, and that I should make the most of this now?
There's certainly an element in that. I would always be fairly proactive in terms of doing things and willing to take things on and stuff like that. And I'd always kind of approach life from the point of view of, I'll say yes until I see reasons why I should decline, rather than going the other way around at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've always been like that, but definitely you're right. There's more of an inclination to engage kind of with, to say about things, look, I'll do it. Yeah, I'll go and do it. Half the times I agree to do things and I'm on my way and I say, what? What was I thinking here? But anyway.
Like you mentioned there the 94% statistic, like, and that the other 6% are in hospital.
And don't, by the way, anybody with medical expertise start ringing in and saying he's wrong. It could be 92 or it could be 92, whatever. But it's in that bracket a lot.
Yeah, and the fact that the remainder are usually in hospital with the equipment available. Where were you when it happened?
I was at home. I had been playing golf with the aforementioned Vincent Hogan. And I came home and I collapsed shortly afterwards, but I had actually left my phone in Vincent's car and I rang him from the house phone and I just said to him, look, if you're not gone too far down the road, I left my mobile in the car, But I've said this before about it. Vincent had said to me, listen, I'm going away off down and can I drop it to you in the morning? There would have been no problem. I would have said, fine, because who needs their phone at midnight? Kind of, from, I don't anyway. And I collapsed just shortly before he arrived back with the phone. And that was the first lucky break, obviously. He found me because I had opened the front door and that. And then he called my wife, Anne, who was in bed upstairs. She started to do CPR. And this is important to mention in this thing for people. She wasn't trained in it. She just did what she knew somebody ought to do, is do something. So she went to work, and the other lucky break in this thing, I definitely used up all the lotto numbers in this one. The other lucky break was the Loughlinstone Hospital ambulance port is just up the road from our house. So the ambulance was down in less than 10 minutes. I think it was 8 minutes. So you've only got a window of time. There's only so long somebody can do CPR before it's game up. So all these things, and as I said, it's just too weird like to kind of think about. But look, it all happened, and that's it's actually a little bit like, you know, you're there from one end of the week, well, not from one end, but whenever you do the lotto, trying to pick the right numbers, and you look at the ticket afterwards and say, gee, I could have got one of them. God, I mean, give me one of them. Kind of, you know? I got them all that night.
It's a pretty amazing story, like, and it's a terrible story, but it's also a really good story.
It's a dramatic story, but it had a good outcome for me. Yeah, yeah. For sure. There's no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that it's great that you're involved with charities around the country who are bringing that story to people, like the whole notion about CPR, people not knowing how to do it.
Yeah.
It is something really that we should be teaching everybody, you know, like the basics of this kind of stuff. Because whether or not you need to use it, it's not a bad thing to know.
Oh, it's not a bad thing to know, or even just the principles of it. I am trained in CPR myself, and I have the certificate and all that kind of stuff. Although, once you get a collapse of the cardiac arrest yourself, you can't actually do CPR on yourself, so that wasn't any good to me. But the point about it is, even the principles of the thing, people should know the broad principles of it and what to do, and you don't have to do the kiss of life or anything like that. What you do have to do is very aggressive compressions of the chest, and that's to keep the blood flow going. There was a man collapsed in a taxi down the road from RTE a couple of years ago, got a cardiac arrest. There were four New York firemen on a break in Ireland coming in a taxi behind, and they knew what to do. They broke three of his ribs. But the whole point about it is, and this is part of the principle of it, what's three broken ribs if you're dead?
Yeah.
You know, so they revived him. They got him to hospital. Everything worked out fine. So his three broken ribs were a very minor.
I'm sure he's delighted with them. Yeah.
Delighted with them, exactly, yeah.
Michael, it seems to me that you have an interest in people, that like the stuff about going around the country, and that you're just happy to go and talk to people. And
sure,
that,
yeah.
That is something that would have, I would say, characterised your presentation style, that you were interested in what was going on, that you had a genuine kind of warmth about it. It never felt like you were going to work. It never felt like you kind of had to. In fairness, some of the panellists down the years were great, so you didn't have to drag too much out of them.
Yeah.
Some of them you had to drag some stuff out of.
Yeah.
But that was kind of, not the philosophy behind it, but that's like the identity of it.
Well, it was my philosophy. And my philosophy about it would be, look, you're presenting a television programme, and there are mechanics that go with it. But I would always make sure, from my point of view, that all the mechanics were done right going to the programme. And I would spend a lot of time during the week on working on that and making sure that I was right in my head where everything was before you showed up in Páirc Uí Chaoimh or Semple Stadium or whatever. And then when you got there, you then had to make sure that you got the balance right between bringing the story of the match and all that, and realising that the Sunday game is an entertainment programme, and it has that element to it as well. And in terms of the panellists, I never had to drag anything out of anybody. The challenge was to shut them up. and it would be quite funny because, you know, people watching the programme, they don't realise that you're wearing an earpiece. And most of the time when Brawley or Spillane or whatever is on a rant, and the director of the programme or the editor of the programme is in my ear, they're going, shut them up. Or they then start talking to them even though they couldn't hear them. Brawley, shut up. All right, okay, we get the point. And all this, but of course they can't hear what the director is saying. I can hear it. And I'm there kind of and listening to the boys and whatever. And I'm like sometimes that close to bursting out laughing because it's actually quite comical sometimes, you know. And I understand it from the programme producer's point of view. They're watching the clock. They've got to go to an ad break. And as you guys know, with advertisers, if you don't take the break within a certain parameter, that the break was promised, then there's a penalty and they get a free couple of ads out of RT or whatever and all that kind of thing. So there'll be all this kind of thing going on in the background, and then you're trying to engage with the lads. But look, that's what the game's all about.
Who was your favourite pundit?
I can't honestly say that from the point of view that I've genuinely enjoyed working with them all, although they've all brought their different stuff to the table and their different challenges. But I guess you would always rely on the go-to person in a situation, and the go-to person in the football panel would be Colm O'Rourke. Because no matter what the others would be up to, you know that you could go to Colm for a bit of balance and to settle the thing down. Cyril Farrell of the hurling panellists, I suppose, but that would be a personal thing because I knew Cyril from Galway back in the day when he was the Galway manager, and we kind of travelled in one aspect or another through that journey for him to then become a seasoned panellist on the Sunday game and all that. But look, they've all brought something special to the table, and that's part of what it's all about.
Was there ever a moment when you thought, we're in trouble here, or anything like that?
I'd say every second Sunday, probably, yeah. Well, we were in trouble a few times, because some of the things that the fellas have said, kind of just, you know, I remember back in the day, going back a fair few years, on the nighttime programme, which I was doing at the time, there was a Ulster Championship match between Derry and Tyrone, and Pat Spillane, it was a fractious encounter, and Pat was doing the analysis of it, and he described the Derry players as thugs in the middle of all this kind of thing. And of course, needless to say, the manure hit the fan and the Derry County Board are going to sue everybody in sight and blah, 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 whatever. And the following week was a hurling Sunday, but the then head of sport, Tim O'Connor, insisted that Pat come back and apologise and retract this thing. And there was no way Spillane wanted to do this. So he's marched up to Dublin anyway. And I have him before the programme and I'm saying, Pat, look, we're not asking you to change your opinion of the match. We all know it was a fairly tough game and all that kind of thing. The word thugs, I said, this is just a problem. So just that word, just pull that back and we're clear out the door. Is that fair enough? Mm-hmm. So anyway, introduce him on the programme. Pat, you know, last week's match, you had some fairly controversial things to say, and I know you want to address that. So he rattles on about it and he said, I suppose in the course of thing, I use the word thugs. I accept I use that, and maybe I shouldn't have said that. But I mean, God Almighty, they committed criminal acts out there. And after the programme finished, Tim O'Connor was on the phone out in the control room, waiting for me. And I picked it, and all he was talking for about 10 minutes. But the only thing. And the only two words I could understand was, you're fired! You're fired! Well, Spillane was then wheeled back for a third occasion, a second go of this thing. And O'Connor has him outside the studio by the lapels. Maybe he didn't have him by the, maybe he had him by the throat or something. I can't quite remember. And say, he had written a script for him. If you change one word of that script, I'll kill you. You know? So that was one of the many, I can tell you, down through the years, and various other things with Brolly and so on.
Yeah, like the ones that kind of come to mind are kind of the more modern ones, like Tyrone Monaghan in 2013, obviously that summer with the Sean Kavanagh incident, and then Puke Football famously.
Of course, obviously, yeah.
Almost as like the 10-year anniversary of Puke Football, Brolly had to outdo it.
I know, but I mean, the thing about it is, going back to the Puke Football, last Sunday on the Sunday game, because it's the 40th anniversary of it, they were doing a montage of various things, and it's not just about a montage of they won a famous All-Ireland here or they won a famous All-Ireland there. Of course, that was part of the package, but guess what? Spillane's Puke Football was in the middle of it there, because that is so much remembered by people. There was another aspect to that. On that day, one of the things that Spillane said was, he was talking about Francie Bellew, who was cornerback on the Armagh team at the time, and he was giving Francie a lot of jip. And he said, my mother is quicker than Francie Bellew, and my mother has a bad knee. And the following week after Armagh won the All-Ireland, Goal used to do this charity match on the Wednesday afterwards. and get the All-Ireland champions to play a selection in it. And in fair play to the Armagh guys and Joe Kernan, Joe was a very good humour, he's a very good humour guy and would take the right attitude to it. So what the Armagh players, they all came out on the pitch with their knees bandaged up, which was quite funny, obviously. But, you know, there was all that aspect of the puke football and then various other things, as we said, down through the years, like that have stuck in people's memory and minds about the Sunday game and aspects of it. Yeah. But the other thing I would say about it, and this goes back to the Brolly rant about Sean Kavanagh and all that kind of thing. Be it the puke football or the Sean Kavanagh rant or other things that ads have caused controversy about, they were actually in principle right in what they were saying. It might have been controversial the way they said it, but the points they were making was valid. And, I mean, after all, that stuff with the Sean Kavanagh thing, I won't say it caused, but it certainly was a precursor to the black card being introduced into football and all that kind of stuff, you know. And there was definitely validity in what they were saying, although, as I said, the manner in which they said it was another story.
Did you feel pressure about that? Because it's a funny job. The notion of Tim O'Connor being as angry as he was, I can understand. But there was also a sense that you're in a big organisation like RTE and a big organisation like the GAA.
Yeah.
And the director generals of both organisations have hotlines to each other if and when something happens. Mm. Were you conscious of that? Was that something that you kind of needed to, or was it ever said? It was like, look, the GAA are very unhappy with a certain specific line here. And how did that tension manifest itself?
Personally, no. That didn't bother me. I hope, had a sense of responsibility towards the Sunday game and to RTE about what I did as the presenter. And I always just wanted to keep a balance on things, to try and keep a balance on things. But let's face it, I knew when the lads were saying controversial things that it was getting the public going and it was getting, you know, and you're there thinking to yourself, OK, I need to just keep a balance on this thing, but this is actually good.
You need to let go too.
Yeah. Who spoke to who afterwards? Who complained to who? That didn't bother me. You know, that was somebody else's problem.
In fairness, no.
I mean, I was never directly told by RTE, don't do this or don't do that or whatever the case may be. But I would be aware, obviously, if there was a hoopla going on between various sporting bodies. In my case, it would be principally the GAA and that kind of stuff. But no, I was never pressurised. And the thing about that is, all that kind of stuff would happen at admin level in the organisation. The people who worked on the programme, be it me or the editor or the producer of the programme, whatever, we operated to make this programme as good as we could possibly make it. And that was our agenda. We couldn't ignore the other agendas that were around it. But at the same time, we pretty much did our stuff and tried to say to ourselves, we're doing a good programme here. The public like it. Is there a problem?
Because, you know, rights holders want their, the owners, they want their product to be promoted as opposed to...
They do, but...
Football.
No, there's no doubt about that. But we are lucky in this country in that the relationship that the national broadcaster has with the major sporting organisations, like, for instance, as we said, in the GEA, there is still a huge amount of editorial control over what we do compared to... Across channel, for example. The Premier League is so big and it means so much to everybody financially involved in this thing. And what we have to remember when we watch, I was going to say Manchester United, I'm a Manchester United fan, but I'm trying not to watch them at the moment. Well, they're finished for the season, so that makes it easy, I suppose. But the point about it is, this is a global product. You can see Premier League football in South Africa or South America, whatever the case is. And there was so much involved here in it. They can't have digs at each other. And it makes a lot of the analysis of issues within soccer, and there are issues within soccer the same as there are in GAA or whatever the case may be, it makes it a lot more diluted, in my opinion, and not as strong editorially as it could be. Because it's big business. Mm. The GAA and RTE, there's a business relationship there, but it hasn't subsumed the editorial side of things.
So when you see stuff like John Horan this week coming out and giving out about RTE picking certain games, what do you make of that?
That's forever been there, you know, and there's always that kind of thing. I mean, when I started on the Sunday game, we would show one match at the weekend, and maybe two if we got lucky, if we got a camera crew to go to a second match and all that kind of stuff. Now, essentially, between the live programme and the nighttime programme, pretty much every match for the weekend is covered in some shape or form, whatever. And you're not going to make everybody happy, you know. And you would get that from the public as well as you'd get phone calls or emails from people. Why in the name of God? Why didn't you show Leitrim? Why didn't you show, you know, all that kind of thing. But fine. Nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
So I mean, John has a reasonable point, but at the same time, it's a balancing act between all this stuff.
The issue of the quality of the sport, the football in particular, over the last half decade or so has reached a point where, for a large portion of it, it's a shadow boxing until we get to an All-Ireland semi-final. Even with the introduction of the Super 8s last year, just the way the structure worked, it wasn't great, and it certainly pales in comparison to hurling at the minute. Should we just have tiers? Should we just bite the bullet and change the game?
Yeah, but this is a work in progress. And this is my opinion, right? The GAA are moving towards a Champions League format of the football championship. But because the provincial councils are more or less autonomous bodies in terms of the provincial championships, they have, each province has control over that. So there's an issue here. Do you ring them up and say, sorry lads, we're taking the checkbook off you because we're running this thing centrally as a Champions League format? And no, it's not really going to work, you know. So what's happening is the championship is gradually moving towards that end. And we're now getting to a point where, let's face it, the provincial championships are becoming irrelevant. And sometimes going into a new season, like this season, for instance, you have to actually remind yourself, who won the Ulster Championship last year?
Yeah.
You know, whereas like 30 years ago, that wasn't a problem because the four provincial winners would be in the All-Ireland semi-final. Whereas now this thing is diluted into what's the Super 8s now in football and all that kind of stuff. So where this structure is at the moment isn't the right place, but it's a step along the way towards getting to the right place. But that has to be a process. I understand the GAA's structuring of this thing and the challenges that they face in getting there. But they will. And as I said, I have no inside information on that, but I'd say I wouldn't be too far right from being right.
Yeah.
One of the issues with the second tier competition has been the idea of coverage for it. Like, where do you come down on that? I mean, does the whole idea of it get completely lost, that ultimately RTE or whoever the rights holders are will just end up showing the top tier and the tier two will get ignored?
Look, again, I make the comparison to football across channel. When we all started, when I started watching Match of the Day and stuff like that, I have to say some of it was great because you'd see matches of teams, Shrewsbury Town baiting the living daylights out of Bolton Wanderers or whatever the case may be, on mucky pitches and small stadiums, and it was full of atmosphere, but it was very kind of local kind of stuff. Whereas now, when was the last time you saw Shrewsbury Town on the telly? Not recently, I know. So yeah, and that happens in sport. You know, the bigger the sport gets, and the bigger the top guys get, and even within the Premier League itself, the difference between the top half of the table and those who are going to struggle, and they're going to struggle before they kick a ball in the season. You know, that's just a reality of it. And from their point of view, the lower teams, all they're hoping for is to get into the Premier League for a season or two, like Brighton, for instance, who obviously sacked their manager, which is very surprising. But at least they're playing top level football, so they're in the kitty, and that means a lot to them. But where's the television revenue? It's in Liverpool and Manchester City and Manchester United, and that's just it, you know. And that applies to all the other sports. That applies to rugby as well as everything else.
Michael, before we let you go, are the Dubs going to do five in a row? What will stop them?
Stats. That's the only thing at this stage. If you look at, for instance, Eugene McGee passed away recently, and of course the Offaly and 82 stopping Kerry from doing the five in a row. I remember the only time that I saw Kilkenny hurling in the county being bullish about the game was the Drive for Five a few years ago. They're very passionate about their hurling, obviously, in Kilkenny. But they're also kind of, you know, they don't go around banging drums.
They're humble.
And, you know, yeah, humble about it and measured and all that kind of thing. But that particular year, I noticed driving around the county, on every, going down through every village or every town, the flags were out, and the signs were out, the Drive for Five. And that didn't happen. And there's history there in other sports, that kind of stuff as well. Does that mean that Dublin can't win it? No, it doesn't. They're in a great position. It's I suppose people would say at this time of the championship, it's theirs to lose.
Is that the weight of history, or is that the power of expectation? Is it, you know, you kind of,
I suppose the more the further you go, the further out you press the button, you're always going, it's like a horse going around the Grand National. If there was one more fence, he might fall at it. You know what I mean? So there's always that issue. It's a tough thing. It's not easy to win a championship, no matter how good you are and how good Dublin are. And they are good, and they have a good structure, and they have a great manager, obviously, and Jim Gavin and all that. But it's not, they're not going to sail through this thing, you know. Yeah. And I would also make the point to people, in that four that they've won already, two of those, they beat Mayo by a point, and one of them after a replay. And the replay, as we know, Mayo basically beat themselves on it. So it's not like that they've stretched away into the distance. They've edged it by that much. Will they edge it by that much again? Let's see.
As a Galway man, would you like to see Mayo be the ones to stop them?
Do you know what? I genuinely have said this. If Galway were not to win the football championship, which I think is a fair prospect at this moment in time, I wouldn't object at all to seeing Mayo win it.
Right.
The only thing about it at this stage is I think they've lost their chance. I think the chance was there for them a couple of years ago, two or three years ago. I'm not sure how many times Mayo can keep going to the well. And with the group of players they had an All-Ireland winning team. They had the players there. Do they still have the players? They will be contenders. They'll be there and thereabouts. But that's just the structure of the championship. But do they have enough to get themselves to the top step? Wouldn't be sure.
On that note, Michael, thanks a million for joining us today. Enjoy the rest of the off-season. So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.